Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, you seen any good movies lately?
No, Jim. I've been reading.
All right, we're here in the basement.
Yes, we are.
We are still recovering from that crazy Oscars last night. I mean, could you believe it?
I know. It was ridiculous.
It was out of control.
I know. The 91st Academy Awards. Yep. Yeah.
This time they not only misread the winning movie, but then when they tried to fix it, they got it wrong again.
Yeah.
And so then it went all the way down to... I think by default, somehow the Will Ferrell Sherlock Holmes movie
won. It's crazy. John C. Reilly, yeah.
Yeah.
And Kevin Hart sprinted on stage to try to present that award at the end. Yeah. Yeah, it was terrible.
It was chaos. It was amazing.
Nuts.
Okay. It was really fun. Now, we decided since it's Oscar time that here on Rockin' the Suburbs, I'm Jim Lenihan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
That we would talk about some music movies today and also tomorrow.
Sounds
what we're
good
gonna
to
do.
Me.
And so today, we're going to talk about some music documentaries, some stuff that we've seen recently. These aren't necessarily our favorites of all time or the best of all time or any of that stuff. This is very similar to what you do with the books. As soon as you read a book, even if it's a 20-year-old book, you want to talk about it, right? So we're going to talk about some movie documentaries. I'm going to kick this off with two that I've seen, both on the same topic. Okay.
Great. Okay.
And they both recently came out on streaming services. One is on Netflix and one is on Hulu. And they both cover this thing called the Fyre Festival. Are you familiar with this?
I've heard of it. It made some news headlines. Yeah.
Yes. So it happened or didn't happen more accurately a couple of years ago. I think it was 2017. And I was unaware of all the hype about this festival and only became aware of it when the news reports about what a disaster it was, hit. And then of course I found great joy in this to see that, that people who were spending literally tens or in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars to attend this supposed luxury festival in the Bahamas, were supposed to be flown down on private planes.
Yeah.
We're supposed to have luxury villas and glamping tents and all this kind of stuff to stay in on a private island to see and hang out with models, frolic with models to see a music festival, ended up living in essentially squalor and chaos.
Yeah.
And were fed things like cheese sandwiches in styrofoam boxes. It was quite exciting. So then you get to see the backstory on this thing. And one of them is on Netflix, and it's just called Fyre, F-Y-R-E.
Okay.
The other one is on Hulu, and it's called Fyre Fraud. I've watched both of them. They are both very interesting. I would say that they are both worth watching if you're interested in this, because the filmmakers have kind of lobbied shots back and forth at each other, because both claiming that each one was like biased in some way.
Oh,
so it probably makes sense to watch them both, and then you get a more complete picture. But the deal is that with the Hulu one, they ended up paying the guy who was at the heart of all this, the organizer, this guy named Billy McFarland, who was in like federal prison now for fraud, for trying to do this, to pull this off.
Took a lot of people's money.
Right. To get him to speak on camera, they actually had to pay him money. And so some people say, well, that automatically ethically discounts that movie.
Right.
Although I will say he didn't really say a lot, so it's really not the heart of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
The other movie, the one on Netflix, is co-produced by the social media company that was involved with promoting the festival.
Okay.
So, of course, they make themselves look good.
Of course.
And everybody else is the villain.
They
in
were
that
innocent.
One.
Yeah.
Whereas in the Hulu one, they kind of take this media company. It's called Jerry Media.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of take them to task a little bit for, perpetuating this fraud.
The social media company.
Right.
Got it. Yeah.
So the other thing I will say too is that the Hulu one goes way more in depth into Billy's background before he launched this scheme.
Mm-hmm.
This was the kind of guy who would have a company that would offer you exclusive access, VIP access to like concert tickets, event tickets, things like that. Things like Hamilton, which you couldn't get tickets to.
Yeah.
But if you went through his company, you could.
Ah.
Apparently, he never had access to any tickets. So what would happen was he would get all this money, you know, charge some crazy premium, get all this money, and then go like day of or day before on like StubHub and buy a bunch of tickets.
Is that right?
And pass them out like at the thing, right? And so so you get a good sense of, you know, what kind of person he was before he launched, hatched this idea to
totally
do this festival, right? And there's a lot more things like that. And he had this company that marketed a credit card for, you know, for millennials, right?
Yeah.
Was made of metal. So the card itself was made of metal.
It was.
And the deal was not only could you use it to charge whatever, but, you know, having the card, kind of like an American Express, whatever card, you know, you would get access to all this exclusive stuff, right?
Right.
And it turned out most of it was just based on like, you could go hang out with them at like some townhouse somewhere in New York, right? Anyway, so you get a lot more detail on that in the Hulu one.
Okay.
His whole background. Whereas the Netflix one has way more detail on the festival itself and all the lead up. Like it literally goes like really in depth into like all the things leading up to the day of show. So because basically they shot this video in the Bahamas, and the video went viral, and they had sort of this whole social media campaign on it to sort of ensure that that would happen. Mm-hmm. And that's what got people to put down to buy the money go to the tickets that were, you know, like I said, in the tens of thousands of dollars, or some VIP packages were literally like over $100,000, right?
Wow.
You know, I mean, I'm sure you can relate. You go to a lot of shows that cost
similar.
You know,
yeah. I mean, if I'm going to go, I'm going to go all the
you
way
want
at the
VIP
tier.
Treatment,
yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Top shelf.
So think about all the logistics that have to go into pulling off a festival, not only just the bands itself. Oh, by the way, did I mention that like they were, that the headlining act was Blink 182?
Oh, no, I didn't know that.
That people were spending tens of thousands of dollars to see, right? So so there's that. And also Ja Rule was one of the big
organizers. I was
going to
ask, how was he involved in the organization of it, or was he just a headliner or a performer?
No, no, no. He was like, he was working with this guy, Billy, to like, sell the whole thing, right? He was sort of the celebrity face of it.
Got
and
it.
They show him a lot being involved in a lot of the supposed planning and all of that. And of course, it's like, as soon as this all fell apart, he said, like, I didn't really have anything to do with this at all.
I never went to those meetings.
I just went down there and drank, you know, which, but anyway, but think about this. So you're going to do however many days it was supposed to be, 2-3 day music festival. So you have all the stages and all the logistics of actual musical event. Mm-hmm. And then you have to house, what was it? I want to say 20,000 people or something like that, right? Because they're all flying in to the Bahamas, to this place. So you have to do all that, and you have to feed them and house them and, you know, presumably have like, you know, medical facilities and, you know, all this kind of stuff, right? And, you know, there's no infrastructure. Like they have to like build everything, right? Because it doesn't exist. And there's a whole big thing about how they pitched this as a private island, and it wasn't at all.
Oh,
it was
really?
Just a site. That like an abandoned, like a not abandoned, a vacant site next to a Sandals resort, you know, on an island that actually was fairly developed, like, as far as the Bahamas go. But anyway, so think about this: you're going to pull all that off, and they had like 6 months.
Wow,
to do it
right from scratch,
right? Yeah. So, and they wanted it to be sort of like a Coachella kind of level of event, mm-hmm. right? It's like it's impossible, and so almost immediately people were like, "We can't do this; it can't be done."
Yeah.
But they had to keep plowing forward because they had taken all these people's money.
Right.
And so it's a story about how you promise something that you can't possibly deliver on, but you just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper into it. Mm-hmm. And then you had to get more investors and figure out ways to get people to spend more money. At one point, they really stressed to the people who had bought the tickets that they need to preload wristbands with money to spend on site, right?
Uh-huh.
And they wanted it. They kept bugging these people to do it because, of course, they need the cash flow.
Yeah,
right. And so it's really a fascinating thing about all this. And then, so I would suggest if people are interested in this, watch the Hulu one first.
Okay.
Because there you really get all the background of this guy himself. And then watch the Netflix one, which goes really deep into the disaster of the festival. And I will say one last thing. It's a really interesting lesson in social media because the way that they got people to spend all this money and buy into this concept was that they used quote unquote influencers.
Oh, right.
People like you and me.
Exactly.
Right.
With millions of followers.
That's right. Yeah.
Our word is gold.
That's right.
Yeah.
But they paid a lot of money to influencers like Kendall Jenner, I think, was one of the ones, right?
She's pretty influential, right? Yeah.
And various models and stuff like that. People have a lot of Instagram followers in particular, and they got them to promote it, and that's what got people to buy into it. So what could have been a social media success story, though, was actually a social media disaster story, because what happened was when the people got there, the paying customers got there, and it was such a huge disaster. You know, they didn't have all this stuff that they promised, and it was chaos, and people were just literally like grabbing whatever tent they could and carrying mattresses around and fighting over food and all this stuff. Anyway, they were posting all this stuff on social media
right
as it was going, and that's where I first heard of all this. So you got to sort of follow in real time what a disaster it was. And they said what was so interesting was that all this money spent to get these influencers who have tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of followers or whatever, it was all ultimately undone by people who didn't have hardly any followers, right? But because what they were posting was so compelling, that stuff went viral, and that was their undoing, right? So actually, there is hope for us.
Yeah, there is. We just got to get involved in some sort of disaster.
So, well, the other thing too is, just in terms of filmmaking, I guess I should get into that a little bit, is there's so much footage today to pull off of, because all the people, all the social media stuff was all, you know, was to a large extent captured on their cameras, right? Yeah. So you have all this stuff that you can sort of piece together and make a movie out of, right?
Right. It's different. That's fascinating too.
Right.
Yeah.
It's really different today than in the past, right?
Yeah.
And so you literally get people like reporting in real time on the scene, you know, just average people, and you can make
it's
a documentary
of
out of that, right?
That's
and
kind of course amazing.
They did interviews, you know, with a lot of the people involved and all that. All right. That's enough about that. That's been a long time. So that's my documentary recommendation.
Yeah. I like it. Sounds good.
All right. Now, what do you got, Patrick?
I got something really quick that I want to talk about. I was, this is the way I'll put it, Jim. Probably about as often as you read a music book, that's probably about as often as I watch a movie, and vice versa, right? You watch as many movies as I read books. It's probably about the same. You watch movies and TV shows constantly.
Okay, all right. You're smarter.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
I got it. That's right.
No, I'm saying that you consume your information in a different way than I do. That's all I'm saying. But he can read.
Teach me to read.
Yeah. He can read.
We've
got to
work on that.
I've seen him read. All right. I've seen him read stuff he's never seen before. Like you put it in front of him, he can read it.
Yeah. Like a beer can.
Yeah stuff like that. Yeah. A fast food wrap or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
I do a lot of reading, and I was perusing some stuff about John Peel not long ago, and came across, you know, an interesting thread. I've always liked the band Mott the Hoople a lot. I've always thought they were a really cool band.
Yes.
And I just didn't really know how much, you know, they kind of influenced some of the punk people, especially Mick Jones from The Clash and, you know, people like that. So there's a documentary. I just happened to stumble upon it. The whole thing was on YouTube. It's called The Ballad of Mott the Hoople. It came out in 2011, directed by Mike Carey and Chris Hall. It talks to everybody who was, you know, the main players in the band: Ian Hunter, Mick Ralphs, Vernon Allen, Dale Griffin, everybody except for their bass player, Pete Overend Watts, is interviewed in this documentary. And it's just a lot of fun, and it kind of tells the story of Mott the Hoople. And it's an interesting story. Their early records were made in 1969, 70, 71. They put out four records, and the first two of those records were produced by Guy Stevens, who produced London Calling for The Clash. And that's another connection between Mick Jones and Mott the Hoople and Guy Stevens. Like he sort of saw this band and was like, you know, this is a great rock band. And he actually got Ian Hunter into the band. But those early records, the early, you know, three or four, especially the first two, are kind of a very, very early country rock. You know, they actually take off from like where Dylan, after his motorcycle accident, came back with that country sound. And they put some rock and roll and soul into it. And, you know, Ian Hunter sings a lot like Bob Dylan. You know, there's no doubt about that. But you know, the documentary is just really interesting and fun. And then it talks about when they were going to break up because, you know, they put out four records. Nobody was really buying them. And then David Bowie encouraged them not to break up because he was such a big fan.
Yep.
And he wrote a song for
him. He said, here's a song.
Yeah. And he actually tried to give them Suffragette City, but they didn't want that.
Right.
And then he gave them All the Young Dudes, and it turned out to be a smash hit. And their career went a little more glam, you know. And they, you know, they toured with Bowie and Queen. Queen opened up for Mötley Crüe on a couple of big U.S. tours, and so they became really tight. And in this documentary, Roger Taylor from Queen talks a lot about those early days. And the other interesting thing is that Ian Hunter wrote a book in 1974. It's called Diary of a Rock Star, and that book was really huge to Mick Jones. He's like, this was the manual on how to be a rock star, but it also had a lot of stuff that was very Spinal Tap-ish. You know, they in the early 70s tour in America, a lot of those things that happened to them, I think some of the Spinal Tap stuff, you know, probably came from that book. I'm sure they, you know, that they read that book when they made the movie, but that's just kind of what it was. But, you know, they all seemed to have a great time, and it was kind of a great ride. And then, you know, in the mid 70s, they kind of broke up, and Ian Hunter left the band, and one of the guys went on to form Bad Company, I believe, an early member of Bad Company. Mick Ronson joined the band, you know, to kind of keep them going. But they put out two albums as Mott, you know, M-O-T-T, without the Hoople part of it. But it's really interesting, especially the stuff about Guy Stevens. He was in prison, and he read a book called Mott the Hoople. And he was in prison on a drug charge. He was a notoriously crazy person. But yeah, it's just a fun thing, and it teaches you a little bit more about the band if you didn't know too much about it, which is kind of cool. And two quick things. One, do you remember when we did novelty songs?
Yes. With Chris Wadsworth.
With Chris Wadsworth.
Yes.
And somebody called in about that song, Life is a Rock, But the Radio Rolled Me.
Yes.
That had all that stuff. Mott the Hoople is name checked in that song.
Yeah.
And also, of course, in the REM song, they are name checked as well, which I found kind of interesting. Man on the Moon begins with Mott the Hoople and the Game of Life.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So those are two things I learned from the documentary as well. It's fun, and it's like 55 minutes. So
I especially like documentaries like this about bands I don't know that much about. I mean, that's what makes it really work.
I learned a lot about the early stuff that I didn't really know, and you can't really get from, you know, like just Wikipedia pages or whatever on the internet. It's really cool to hear Ian Hunter especially talk about his, you know, experiences. And they got together, the original members, in 2009 and did a reunion in England and played three shows, and that was kind of the impetus for this whole documentary that eventually came out in 2011.
But I only know them really as the glam band. I don't really know this other
stuff
that you're talking about so much.
Oh, man, it's so good. That first album, I really like it a lot. There's a cover of a Sir Douglas Quintet song called At the Crossroads. Killer tune.
All right.
Yeah, check it out. So that's it. It was fun.
So there you go, listeners. You got some watching to do.
That's right.
Crank up the RCA.
Yeah.
Get the Zenith.
That's right.
Get that going. All right.
Get the VHS, or if you have Beta, Betamax.
Beta, especially the Betamax. You want that. Or the Laserdisc.
That's right.
All right, we got to get out of here. But tomorrow, we're going to talk about some just like more music movies.
Yep.
That we've recently seen. Mm-hmm. Some fictional stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And let us know about any music documentaries that you guys like. You can email us rock@suburbspod.com. You can call, leave a message,
612-440-1984.
Or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of those at Suburbs Pod. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And we'll talk to you guys tomorrow. Just rode on through.
It's American cheese.